What's it sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning?
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading more chapters from Your Head is a Storehouse, memoirs by George Winder Thompson of Cedar Grove, North Carolina. Chapter 5, The Money-Making, Work. We never had much money, but we were always proud that we owned our own home and had something to eat from the food we raised. We raised everything: cabbage, tomatoes, okra, snap beans, peas, corn, squash, collards, turnip greens, watermelons, and sugarcane. I remember the Poteets had a cane mill, and we had horses that pulled the bar to turn the wheel, which in turn squeezed the juice from the cane to make molasses. As for meats, we raised hogs, chickens, and cows. When a cow got unproductive, or stopped having calves, Papa would kill it and sell off the best beef cuts. We fed our hogs a lot of corn, wheat chaff, grass, apples, scraps from the kitchen table, plenty of water, even gave them milk sometimes. And by hog-killing time in November, they weighed around 400 to 500 pounds, same as those hogs Miss Miranda said was fed with backing, and some larger. Since we didn't have refrigeration to preserve the meat, we killed hogs during cold weather and put salt on everything and hung the quartered meat up in what we called the smokehouse. Hog meat paid for many of our needs, for Papa would trade a ham for food, clothes, or farm supplies that he got earlier in the year. Hog meat sold really good anywhere, but we ate every piece of the hog, down to the pig's feet. We also raised cows. We sold milk and butter, too. We had an old-fashioned churn that had a long handle, about the size and length of a broom handle. It had a crossbar at the end of it. You would put the crossbar into the handle into the churn first, making sure it went down into the clabbered milk. That's what we called milk that was left to sour and curdle. The churn had a fitted top with a hole in it, which was placed over the handle. Once the handle was down into the milk, the fitted top kept the handle and the milk from coming out of the churn while you were churning, up and down, up and down. That's how it was done. After about 30 minutes, the butter would have separated from the milk and risen to the top. So we took the top off the churn and then took the handle out so that we could skim the butter from the top of the milk. What was left was buttermilk, and we drunk it with cornbread and vegetables.
Cabbages, cabines, and crops. Crops and cabines and cabbages, sweetest of flowers that I love so. I love to sit there and watch them grow. Some people like rhododendron, and some forget me not.
One of my first jobs as a youngster was stripping cured tobacco with Arthur Richmond. As I mentioned earlier, the Richmonds lived next door to us. There were four boys: Junius Albert, Odie, Arthur, and Lonnie. Junius Albert and Odie were barbers. I would get my hair cut about twice every month. Either one would cut it. The other two boys, Arthur and Lonnie, worked in the city. The oldest, Arthur, did a little farming on the side. At night during harvest time, he would get neighborhood boys to help him tie tobacco. He got me most of the time, and I really enjoyed that, 'cause you see, he would pay me, not with corn and beans, but with that green stuff. Our main job was tobacco farming. That's what we called tobacco. In those days, we worked in tobacco from spring to November, and from sunup to sundown. In March, we'd sow the tobacco seeds in a plant bed. We'd clear a place near the woods that was about 100 feet long and 10 feet wide, and we'd rake all the trash, sprigs, drag off all the trees and rocks off the land to make a good soft bed to plant the tobacco seeds in. Watering and fertilizing made them grow. Near the middle of May, the plants would be about 5 or 10 inches tall. Time to set them out in the field. The tobacco rows had already been prepared. We'd pull up enough plants from the bed to plant an acre of tobacco at a time. You had to know how to plant that stuff. In dry weather, we used a planter. In wet weather, we used the peg. Somebody would have to come along behind you and water the plants so that they would live. The rows had about 200 hills in them, and that would nearly break your back by the time you got to the end of the rows. With the peg, there was more bending. We had to chop or plow the fields to keep the grass out. There were no tractors back then. At least we didn't have one, so we plowed with mules and horses. After planting, that's when the real work started. When the tobacco plants, really a stalk by now, had grown to be about 3 feet tall, we pulled the suckers. Suckers look like little tobacco plants growing right where the leaf and stalk met, in order that they didn't soak up all the nutrients that were meant for the leaves. We topped the tobacco, too. A beautiful bloom grows straight out of the top of the stalk, and we had to break that top off so that the tobacco leaves could grow as big and wide as possible. We picked the juicy tobacco worms and the insects from the tobacco plants to keep them from destroying the leaves and eating the crop as well. All over the tobacco fields, when Papa felt that the leaves were ripe enough to fill one or two barns, we'd start priming. It took the whole family. Willie, Jules, and Bluford, my older brothers, split the stalks with a tobacco knife from top to bottom, stopping 3 or 4 inches from the ground so the stalk wouldn't split all the way. Then they cut the whole stalk from the ground. My sister Nanny Lou would walk alongside my brothers and hold the sticks so they could put the stalks on the stick. It would take about 6 to 8 stalks to get a stick full. It was my job to keep Nanny Lou supplied with sticks. Later, when I got grown, tobacco priming was different. A horse would pull the slide down the rows while we pulled 3 or 4 ripe leaves from each stalk, beginning at the bottom of the stalk. Then we would put the leaves into the slide. The horse, and later a tractor, would pull the full slide to the barn where the tobacco, in bundles of 3 or 4 leaves, would be strung on a stick, one bundle tied on the left side of the stick, the next one on the right, then left, then right, and so on, until the stick was full of bundles. But in those early days, after we got a wagon load of sticks of tobacco, our horse or mule would pull the wagon to the tobacco barn so it could be cured. Our barns had one door, and we'd stop the wagon near the door. My sister Geneva stayed on the wagon and passed the sticks of tobacco down to Ida Kate, who stood on the ground near the barn door. Ida Kate passed the tobacco to Lily, who stood inside the barn door, and handed the sticks of tobacco up to Willie, who would be standing on the bottom tier pole inside the barn. I sometimes spelled, that's what we said for relieved, my sisters when they got tired. Jules or Bluford would straddle the tiers way above Willie, like on the 4th or 5th tier, and working together, the two of them would place the sticks of tobacco neatly into each room until the barn was full. Our tiers were round wooden poles, which stretched from the front of the barn to the back, and in rows above each other. The first tier began about 5.5 feet from the floor of the barn, and tiers went on up in the barn until they reached the A-shaped roof where there were short tiers. The space between tobacco tiers was about 4.5 feet wide and 4.5 feet high. Willie, straddling the bottom tiers, would start at the back of the barn and place a stick of tobacco on the first tier pole. Then he'd place a stick of tobacco on the second tier, and on, in that order, until it was too high for him to reach. And then he'd pass the sticks on up to Jules or Bluford, who would fill the upper tiers in the same way. We filled the barn from the right far side first, and then we'd fill the next room on the left of the completed room, and then we'd go to the far left and fill that room, leaving the middle room last to fill. We filled the middle room about 3/4 full, filling the top tiers first so that the brother who was on the upper tier could be able to have room to come down out of the barn and also have enough light to see what we were doing. Willie could easily finish the barn out from the first tier. We used lanterns to see by and used them in the house, too, because we didn't have electric lights when I was a boy. Once the green tobacco is hung in the barn, you have to cure it. But before you can cure the tobacco, you have to prepare the barn. We daubed, or patched with mud, holes to insulate them, and the furnace. The barn had two furnaces, one on the right side and one on the left side. They extended to about 7 feet or 8 feet into the barn. At the end of the furnace, we put a slofer, to channel that heat from the fire in the furnace into pipes that went all around the barn on each side. We placed logs in the furnace, then we lit them. We kept the fires going as long as it took to cure the barn of tobacco. Now, curing tobacco is turning the leaves from green to yellow. We kept a thermometer in the middle of the barn to register how hot it was. We started the fires and raised the heat to 90 degrees. We kept it at 90 degrees till the barn was warm and about a quarter of the leaves had turned yellow and the leaves became soft to touch. Then, slowly, we moved the heat to 110 degrees, and we'd stay at 110 until almost all the leaves yellowed. Then, slowly, we'd raise the heat to 120 until the whole barn yellowed. After all the leaves turned yellow, it's time for drying, which is making sure there's no moisture left in the leaves and stalks. We slowly raised the heat to 160 to 170 degrees, checking all the time to see if the bottom tier of stalks was dry. If they were dry, 9 times out of 10, the top was dry. If the barn is insulated good and tight with mud, then the thermometer would not have to move any higher than 180 or 185, or maybe 190 degrees, to kill it out, which was what we called it when there was no moisture left. This method of curing tobacco was called flue-cured. Normally, it took overnight to kill that stem, and it took 2 to 3 days to cure the barn of tobacco, because you'd have about 500 sticks of tobacco, with round 6 to 8 or 8 to 10 stalks on a stick, and around 12 leaves on a stalk. We had to watch that heat and listen for leaves falling. You couldn't go home and leave the barn unattended, so we brought bed ticks and quilts to sleep on. One stayed awake while the other caught a nap. Sometimes, during those long nights, my Uncle John Arch and his son Joe, now recognized as one of the most outstanding black string musicians in the country, and Uncle Jake would drop by and strike up a tune on the fiddler and banjo. Boy, we enjoyed that. When it was your turn to mind the barn, you couldn't afford to fall asleep, because the loss of a barn meant you couldn't pay the bills you owed for the merchandise you'd gotten on credit. Once me and Bluford took a load of tobacco off to the market in Roxboro to sell, and when we got back, Mama told us, the big barn went down in smoke. That was a 5-room barn of tobacco. And even though we were curing our last barn of tobacco for the year, it wasn't our best grade of tobacco, but we were still outdone, because that was the biggest and best barn we had. After curing comes stripping. Stripping meant tying the dried and cured leaves into bundles. We would store the cured tobacco in our feed barn, or in the basement of the barn or pack house, where there was plenty of room to spread the tobacco out and keep it moist. You could work with it well then. Otherwise, the leaves would crumble into little pieces, fine enough to roll into a cigarette. We'd open the doors and let dampness hit the leaves, or move it early in the morning while the dew was on the ground, so that it would be in order, or soft to touch, to work with. We moved about 100 to 200 sticks of tobacco from the feed barn to the pack house to make it ready for the market, where it was to be sold. If any of the 200 sticks was crumbling, we'd put those sticks back in the basement and work on the tobacco that was in good order. On a few occasions, we thought we had dried the tobacco out, but when we were getting it ready for the market, we'd run onto leaves that was not fully dried and had mold on it. We put them where the sun would finish drying them, and if mold was still on the leaves, we'd put alcohol and snuff on them to clean them up. Most of the family would be needed to get the tobacco ready for market. Usually, I was the one who took the stalks off the tobacco sticks and the leaves off the stalks. Then it was time for grading, which meant we separated the best tobacco leaves from the worst. My sisters would help my mother grade the leaves. Mama was real good in grading, too. She showed us how to put them in piles by the quality of the leaves. The best grade, the golden silk wide leaves, went into a pile called wrappers. They also brought the most money at the market. The second best grade was called cutters. The third grade was lugs. And the fourth grade was the worst, the sand lugs. This grade was made up of anything that was not good enough for the good grades and not bad enough to throw away. They were shorter and had dust on them because they grew nearer to the ground, and often the leaves were ragged, browner, more speckled than the lugs, and always brought the least amount of money. After all the leaves was separated, it was time to put them in bundles. Picking up leaves in one hand, you hold them by the stem of the leaf between your thumb and first finger. Once you get as many as you can hold, you got to tie them in a bundle. With the free hand, you pick up a leaf from the first or second grade and take the leaf, fold it in half, and then fold it in half again to make the leaf about an inch and a half wide. While still holding the bundle, wrap the folded leaf around the top of the bundle about two times and open the bundle of leaves right in the middle and put the tie leaf there, tight. My sisters and my mom could make that wrapping beautiful. Watching them, I learned how to do it too. Then we'd take it to the market. At the market, the workers would stack it on a basket for sale, and the auctioneers would come through and put a price on it. Nowadays, after the farmers sort the leaves, they don't tie it in the bundles. They put the leaves in a bale, pack it away in the basement to keep it in order, and then take it to market. After the last barn of tobacco has been harvested and cured, it will be around the end of August or the first of September, and the warehouses where you sell your tobacco would be open by then. Sometimes we'd go down east, way below Raleigh, to get that early money, where the tobacco warehouses opened earlier than the ones in Mebane and Durham that were closer to us. I've witnessed three generations of tobacco growing in the state of North Carolina over the years. It's a world of difference than what we did when I was a boy. Because of all the inventions and electricity, the hard labor has been cut by more than half. A man can raise 100 acres of tobacco with just 4 hired hands. That used to take several farmers, mules, and several hired hands. All of the little jobs I had and tobacco farming we did back then was for money to pay the bills, buy the food that we couldn't raise, and buy us clothes. When Mama emptied the chicken feed and flour sacks, she'd make dresses for my sisters. She was a good seamstress. We just got 1 pair of winter shoes, maybe 2 pairs of overalls during the winter, and mostly went barefooted in the summer. Sometimes our shoes lasted longer because we would mend them ourselves using a device called a shoe last. Sometimes you just had to be creative in the ways you provided for your family.
I was standing on East Cairo Street one day. I was standing on East Cairo Street one day. Standing on East Cairo Street one day. One dime was all I had. Mama, don't treat your daughter mean. Mama, don't treat your daughter mean. Mama, don't treat your daughter mean. That's the meanest woman a man must ever see. You want your friend to be bred like Jesse.
Chapter 6, A Boyhood's Dream. My Horse, Nellie. One Saturday evening, I believe it was, Odie Richmond, my barber, the neighbor who lived just above Mama's house, was going to visit a friend who lived in Alamance County and asked me if I wanted to ride along with him. I was much older then than I was when I used to help him bundle tobacco. Anyway, I said, yeah, I'll go. When we got to the man's place, he came driving up with his mule. He'd been plowing, and he stopped and said, hello, fellas. And we said, hello. Then he and Odie started talking. Odie said, looked like you're doing a good job farming. Nah, I've been a good farmer, but this is my last year of it. Gonna quit farming, gonna hang it all up, gonna sell everything. I said, you gonna sell that mule? He said, yes, sir, I'll sell him just like he stands. Hooked up to the plow and everything? Harness? Plow and all? I said, what you want for him? He said, I'll take $35 for her and all the trimmings. Then I said, well, I got my heart set on a horse, and I'll look around, but if I can't find one, I'll be back to talk to you about that mule. We being farmers, my parents had told me some time ago that if I would get me a horse or a mule, the government would give me 4 acres of tobacco, and I'd receive 3/4 of the profit when it was sold, and that they'd help me plant and harvest it, too. The government had cut everybody's tobacco allotment back then, so there was not enough acreage for all of us brothers to get enough on our one farm. Meantime, the following Saturday, I went down to see Mr. Vinson, later my wife's father, and I told him that I was looking for a horse to buy. And he said, well, A man passed by here the other day with a load of horses. As a matter of fact, he don't live far from here, about 2 miles down the road. We can go over there now. Do you want to go over and see his horses? And I said, yes, sirree. And we went over to the man's farm. When we got there, this particular horse was in the barn and in his stall. When I got out of the car, he stuck his head out of the window and neighed. And he was such a pretty animal, I just fell in love with him right there on the spot. He had a wide white strip in the middle of his face, and the rest of his head was brown. Just around his midsection was a brown coat wrapped all around his belly. He looked at me and whinnied once more, so I went over and rubbed his nose. Now, I called the horse a he, but it was a she. But it don't make no difference what you call him, whether it's a boy or a girl. The only thing that makes any difference is, will she work? Will he plow a field the way you want him to whenever you hitch him up? I asked the guy, would he sell her? He said, yeah. Then I asked, what would he take for her? He said, well, I got $180 invested in her. I said, oh, I don't have that kind of money. And slowly we left. I brought Mr. Vinson back to his house, and I came on back home. I prayed to the Lord over it, and the next morning one of the owner's wage hands was sent to tell me to come back. He asked me, was you the man who came looking at that horse yesterday? I told him that I was. He said, well, the boss man told me to come up here and tell you to come back. I told him, ain't no use for me coming back, because he said he had $180 in the horse, and I don't have that kind of money. But he kept on saying, he said for me to tell you to come on back. And I said, well, I can go back, but you know, I ain't got the kind of money he was asking. But I went on back, and when I got there, the owner said, you still interested in that horse? I told him, yes, sir. He said, you want to see him work? Want to see her plow? I said, yes, sir, I sure do. So the man caught the horse, took her out the stall, put the harness on, and hooked her to a plow. And she started plowing, but the land was leaning, not level, downhill-like, and she started walking real fast. Also, it had rained that night, and so it left a puddle of water near the end of the row. But the man, the owner, he wanted the horse to walk through the puddle of water, but the horse was trying to bear around the water, and when she started pulling that plow around the puddle, the man hit her hard with the line. The horse jumped that puddle of water, and she just whirled around that row by herself and was coming back up to where I was standing. That got him. That poor man, he could barely hold on to the ropes and the plow. Looked like the horse was dragging him along. He'd lost control. So when the man got back up where I was, he said, boy, you still want this horse? I said, yes, sir, but I ain't got but $75. He said, sold. Just like that, before I could even get the words out of my mouth. That's how come I say the Lord gave the horse to me. 'Cause he had $180 in her, and any goose would want to get their money out and would want to get some extra. He took my money, and I got somebody to go over later that day to bring her home. I named her Nellie. I named her that because I had had a black horse named Nellie before, who died during one of the cold winter months. So I kept the name out of respect for my black Nellie that I'd lost. I would rub Nellie, pet her, feed her, and turn her out in the lot, and sometimes tried to ride her bareback. And so, after a while of bonding with her, I decided to see, would she work? Put her to a test. So I hooked her to a plow. Mama and Papa had a little old log cabin behind our main house, and when you come down to the log cabin, it was a little road. Really, it was a path, but it was wide enough to drive a wagon or car in it. On the right side of that path was a small tobacco field, and on the left side was what we called new ground, where we had not long cut the wood off, and the stumps and everything off of it. Even the lespedeza hay had been cut away. I started plowing Nellie in the tobacco field. Nothing was left from people priming except the stubbings, or the stalks, standing up. When you plowed, the stubbings would go under the swing tree and snap back up real quickly, and they would make a sound like swish, swish. Sounded like the sound a switch makes. And so each time she heard that sound, she would get nervous and start stepping fast, getting a little faster and throwing her head up and ears back, listening. And I would talk to her all the time that was happening. Easy, girl. Easy, girl. I took her out of that field where the tobacco stubbings was, and put her over in the other side, where there won't no stalks or nothing in that field, and she walked just as pretty as you want to see. Then I took her back to the tobacco field, where she was into the stubbings again, and as soon as the stubbings got to hitting the swing tree again, she got a little nervous. I said, "Easy, easy, girl, easy, girl. Everything gonna be all right. Everything gonna be all right." Finally, she calmed down. I had a feeling that someone had beat that horse, and I was convinced of it when I put her back into the stubbings. That switching sound frightened her every time. She needed a lot of loving to get rid of that fear. She finally came to understand me better than some folks do. I kept rubbing and talking to her. I just kind of trained her. I started bringing her around the house on Saturday evenings when we weren't working, and I turned her loose in the yard with a rope. Had some pretty grass in the yard, and so I let her eat around the house. Finally, I got so I could turn her loose with just the bridle on, and she'd eat till she got full, and then come to where I was. I'd rub her, put her in the pasture, and let her go completely free. Later, I could pull the bar out the pasture gate, and let her roam free without a bridle or nothing. She'd make her way up to Mama's house and eat a while. Then she'd take off running down that highway towards Miss Tilly's, throwing her head up in the air and hiking her tail, and in a little bit, here she'd come back, just as fast as she could fly. And I'd go toward her, and when she'd get to me, she'd stop, and I'd rub her and say, "Come on." I'd take her back down to the pasture, and she'd walk right in and go about her business. A neighbor's wife used to say, "That boy got a wild western horse. He ain't going to be able to work that horse." But it won't long before she saw me plowing Nellie, and she didn't know what to think, because Nellie was just as calm, graceful, strong, and obedient as she could be. Another time I was plowing in the same field. This field was next to the highway and close to the Richmond's farm, and a man came by. I believe he was a salesman. He stopped down at the end of the row. I was at the other end. I thought he wanted to see me, so when I got back down on the end where he was, I stopped to see what he wanted. He said, "Son, go ahead, go ahead. I want to see that horse work." I gave Nellie the giddy-up signal for a horse. That means keep going. A signal made with your tongue at the roof of your mouth. Sounds like... She just took right off and walked right where you put her. I plowed one or two more rows. He just sat down and watched, and at the end of my fourth row he said, "Boy, I've got to give it to you. I got two horses just like that, and they won't pull the hat off your head." "Yes, sir, I got two. Neither one of 'em will pull the hat off your head." I owned Nellie for 23 years. When she started getting old, losing weight, I was afraid to work her, and I wanted to sell her before something happened to her. And I was fortunate to find a man coming around buying old horses. I was so happy because I couldn't have stood waking up one morning finding her dead. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.